Thank you for joining us for the first podcast episode in a five-part series brought to you by the 2020 Influential Women in Legal Tech, rightfully named and selected by the International Legal Technology Association. Today, you'll meet three of the five named 2020 women as they discuss the impact of COVID-19 on the lawyer's role. Without further ado, I pass the microphone on to Jackie Nagatal, who is calling in from Cape Town, South Africa.
Thank you so much, Samantha. So today, I'm joined by two very innovative women that I've connected with throughout the year. And we've shared insights and passions and learned a lot about what each other do. It truly is a testament to ILTA and the sense of community that they provide. First off, we'll go alphabetically, is Alice Namuli Blasevic. She's a partner at Katendi Simpebwa and Company of Advocates and co-founder of the Legal Innovation Hub. Alice is an award-winning lawyer. She's an international speaker, author, innovator. This year, everywhere I have looked, I've seen Alice. She truly is innovative. And then we've got Maria Gonzalez Espejo. She is the vice president of the European Legal Technology Association and the managing partner at the Institute of Legal Innovation in Madrid, Spain. I'm Jackie Nachtigal. I'm a lawyer and qualified futurist. I run an organization called Law for All, where we try to make the law more accessible through alternative approaches and technology. I think all three of us have had a lot to grapple with this year, and I don't think it's over yet, as many countries are experiencing second waves, and it's truly tested agility and motion in a sense. And it's something us lawyers aren't always too fond of, but it's been a very valuable experience, as many of us have learned a lot. And today we're going to talk a little bit about the lawyer's role in COVID and how COVID has influenced the role. You know, as lawyers, we obviously play so many parts and so many roles to different organizations. We manage our own law firms and our businesses, but we also have a critical role to play in our clients' lives. So part of that has been advising them on COVID and helping them respond to the crisis, a very difficult thing to do as there's been very little certainty. Alice, I wonder if you can kick it off by telling us what the lawyer's role has been in advising clients on the COVID response tactics and how you think lawyers have helped in kind of creating survival plans for businesses and the people that you advise.
Thank you very much, Jackie. What I'm going to share, of course, experience in our law firm, but also generally within different countries because of the different platforms I am on that where I usually share. And what we've seen, especially from the beginning, the first thing most clients were worried about was employment regulations, because if you remember at that time, like the first lockdowns we had, most people were like, okay, what do we do with all this, the staff? Who do we get rid of? Who do we stay with? There was a panic. And because the lockdown took such a long time, so many clients just were very uncertain and just not so sure of how to handle their employees. Now, in my country, you're not allowed to get rid of, I think, more than 10 employees at a go. So there are all these like requirements or things you're supposed to do before you do something of that sort. So what we did definitely to help them was more of advise them, give out like different like trainings, first of all, on what they should do, what they must know, that's number one, about our employment laws and labor laws, and what they can do to actually help them to either reduce their staff or handle their staff. And that's really helped them a lot. The other thing was, how about the other employees who we can, you know, get rid of short term, but then, you know, keep paying them. There were all these like structures definitely we had to come up with on how to deal with employment, and labor issues definitely became a very, very big thing. Like every day we're getting an inquiry on that. So I thought so many of our clients appreciated that. The other one was about vulnerabilities that came with working from home. As you all know, again, after the lockdown, we were all sent home, and it became a little bit difficult for so many companies to deal with the new shift. But as many of them were able to cope and, of course, send their staff home, it turned out that there were so many vulnerabilities these companies exposed themselves to in the area of cybersecurity. They had ended up now with more hacks or attacks because so many of their employees had no idea how to deal with the kind of networks they were using to access their work from, you know, the cloud systems. So What we did was to carry out some kind of trainings on cybersecurity, data protection. And first we issued some kind of updates to all our clients, but of course, some of them, you could find that they needed more of our advice than rather our help than others. So we helped them to also, or referred like cybersecurity experts who could basically help them to deal with all these security issues they were having. So those are the two key things that I could...
It's an interesting topic that you brought up about labor law, because I think by now many entrepreneurs and business owners have become keen experts in labor law as they've had to figure out how to go about it. Yeah. But also, I don't know if you have any comments on how do you think labor law stands to change in our new remote environment?
I will first give an example in Uganda. We even had some kind of policies that or guidelines that were issued by the Ministry of Labor that, yes, they were aware that this is what the law is, but because of COVID, they came up with some kind of requirements that you shouldn't let go of your employees within this particular time. But also when it comes to remote working, because our laws require, like, for example, physical presence or for you to work within for certain hours, yet for working from home, people have been working for more than 8 hours, you understand? So definitely has to be a shift. There has to be some kind of amendment. Right now, what is happening is that people, like every company or business, they're just trying to come up with their like internal policies to take care of, I guess, the situations that a company is experiencing. But at the same time, being very mindful of the existing laws. Definitely existing labor laws, some of them contradict to what definitely we are facing right now.
Absolutely. I think that also brings into mind, I mean, the role of the lawyer is not just in advising the clients. And in the trying times that we have, a lot has to be changed and there's going to be a lot of innovation in laws and how we do things. But another interesting part of that is, what is the ethical role of the lawyer? You know, as we see so many businesses grappling and that can't afford the services of a lawyer, is there some duty on the lawyer to provide service to, you know, in these compromised economies? I don't know, Maria, maybe you can share some insights on that.
Yes, Jackie, I think that lawyers have always have this duty of helping. I think that at the moment, this duty is double. On one side, because a lot of people are not only the traditional low-income citizens, but now and growing, all these companies, all these businesses that are going to be out of the market. In Spain, we will have the big hit in January. That's what everybody expects, because that's when it will finish the new, let's say, aid that companies are getting. But at a certain moment, this kind of sustained with finance, public finance will finish. And then these business people will have to take the decision of what do I do next? So they will probably have to close. So we expect a lot of businesses going out of business. Let's see what lawyers will do, because if you have a client that has been with you for many years and this client doesn't have any money for restructuring or for negotiation with the banks or for helping with the search of new finance and the legal part of it, I guess that a lot of, let's say, free work will have to be done. That's, let's say, one part of the duty that I think that lawyers will have to do. And secondly, I think that in many countries, my country is one of the examples, this continuous need to regulate under unknown circumstances and unknown situations have ended up with a continuous enactation, I don't know if you say that in English, or continuous drafting and publication of new regulations. And this, of course, the quality of many of these new rules is not always so good. So there have been a lot of situations where the fundamental rights, our constitution was, let's say, in danger. And I think that in that sense, lawyers have, let's say, a duty of being a part of the control system of the, because even politicians, I mean, politicians here are engaged in a big quarrel. We don't know if the best measures are being taken. I don't think that at all times it has been the case. In many cases, political issues, political agendas have been more important than the health of the citizens. And in all those situations of fast regulations or situations where everything is new, lawyers have been there to, let's say, claim breaches of the laws. They have been writing articles in the newspapers. They have been participating in radio and TV programs. And I think that this will probably keep on being the same for several months, because here we have now a new alert situation until April or May. So we are exactly like 1 year ago, more or less, and it doesn't look very good. And so that's, I think that, yes, they have a big duty in front, and it will be even more important in the coming months. And not only here, of course, I think that in most countries, because this is a pandemic. Yeah. This is not a nation problem.
Yeah, absolutely. We have seen that in South Africa. I mean, the velocity of regulation that came out to kind of circumvent everything in South Africa was astounding. But as you say, it's been so politicized that and poorly drafted. So there are so many loopholes and so many gray areas, because they're coming out. I mean, at a stage, they were coming out by the day, new regulations and new control measures, and they weren't well thought out. So we've had many, many cases go to the Constitutional Court testing the validity of them. I don't know if you know much, like in South Africa, when we went into lockdown, alcohol sales were banned, smoking was banned. You know, a lot of other political agendas came into the thing. So the lawyers played a critical role in kind of finding our way through that. But none of our constitutional cases have been found in the favor of the people, which was very interesting and strange. But it does, I think, illustrate again the ethical role and the role that the lawyer plays to society as large. You know, it's not just the political landscape. The lawyer is incredibly important in that. How has your experience been, Alice, in Uganda?
Definitely. We've had a few cases. One of them, I would say, was in regard to data breach, or because there was a time when I think the government of Uganda had called or attracted calls for innovations in contract tracing, you know, for COVID victims. But then so many activists came out wondering, what is government going to use this data for? Will it misuse it? Will it repurpose it without the consent? You know, all these kind of things. So those are, I do remember vividly someone coming up with a case of that nature in regard to data breach or infringement on privacy of the citizens.
Yeah, I think privacy was quite an interesting topic, as we were traced and you have to write your name at every place that you go into. And even in the employment place, that having to disclose the health record of someone. So that was also in itself a very interesting thing. Talking back to the ethical role, I mean, in South Africa, I saw a lot of pro bono work being done. I saw a lot of my colleagues and friends do work that they, took on the extra time to advise. I don't know if you have any nice stories to tell to kind of change do a bit of PR for the legal profession, and share anything of a specific story or a lawyer that really acted like a hero during this time. I don't know, Maria?
Yeah, well, in Spain, there was an interesting movement. It was an association set up during the COVID, the starting of the pandemic, called covidwarriors.org. You can check it in the internet. And what I like of it is that it's not only lawyers, it's interdisciplinary. And what they have been doing is finding concrete solutions for concrete problems that were being raised like every week. One week it was the people who was dying alone in the hospitals, not being able to say even bye to their families because they didn't have a telephone or money to buy the telephone. Or one week after, it was the tool that we all had to use to inform. And what these people have been doing is work together with the other professionals, but helping them with all the legal aspects, mainly data protection and other law tech issues. And I think that that was really nice. Another hero, I think, in our country have been a judge. There was also a lady, I can't remember her name. His name is Akairo. And this guy has been the judge that did the first virtual online trial. And he is like a hero in the sense that, you know, he is showing that this can happen. He is in the administrative field, so trials against administration. And today I just read an article that he has written explaining what he's doing now. So he is like pushing this forward. And now he's in the region of Santander in the north of Spain. So he's an exception because, you know, the funny thing is that here, apparently we have the legal framework that would allow judges to do this, but you depend on the technology that your region supplies you with and also on your own will. So I don't like that. I always say that it's very unfair that imagine if I go to this judge in Santander, unlucky because maybe I like virtual life, but if I go to a judge, I don't want to say the city, no lucky because this guy doesn't like virtual life. And I don't like that because I think that that's unfair. You know, that's at least it's not equity in that. So I don't like that we have this freedom of becoming virtual. But on the other hand, I like that there can be somebody, two, three people that has already created an example and can serve as models of what can be done. And this guy now, he is setting up workflows on the different kind of administrative procedures, because what he pretends is that in the future, apparently at the moment in all the justice system, there are a lot of people leaving and coming back and substitutions, replacements. So they have a lot of instability in the the staff. And what he says is, you know, it's a problem because then you have to be training people all the time. And when somebody leaves, then they don't know what to do next. So now what he wants to do is like these staff officials in the court, they don't have to more or less take decisions. They just do follow the workflow and the documents will be there with templates so they don't have to think. So that's what he's doing, which I think is fantastic. And it's a great example. Yeah. He's a hero, I think.
Absolutely. I'm going to get back to that because I want to ask you on that future and the work that you're doing with your universities. But Alice, first share with us if you have any stories of some lawyer heroes.
Well, what I can actually say, apart from maybe the lawyers who are taking on these cases pro bono, but what has happened, I mean, since, of course, March, this whole COVID thing, what we have seen is so many innovators, legal innovators, coming up with platforms to enhance access to justice. Like, for example, there's a platform I'm working on. I know you know about this, Jackie, it's called Jour, but now locally there's one of the innovators who has come up with a similar platform, but it's not on blockchain. It's a plain platform like any other, I mean, using different technology, where you're able to file a complaint online and then have a virtual hearing, and then everything can be done online, which I thought that actually that could be quite amazing. And of course, responding, and all this is like done, you know, it's all pro bono, but it is yet the response, because people are not very used to using this kind of platform. So I think they've not got good response in terms of using the platform. But I thought that was quite innovative. I mean, in these times, coming up with, you know, a platform like that.
So do you think legal technology has been the era of COVID?
Definitely. I believe, because
it really,
it has been increasingly used, and people are being able to actually appreciate it, both the lawyers and also the litigants. But for the litigants, I think it's definitely much slower. The lawyers since the COVID breakout, they're more willing to or receptive to legal technology.
Yeah, I think a large part, as Maria also said, is being driven by the courts. When the courts go online, lawyers are forced to adopt technologies that they haven't adopted before. And I think the legal tech space has really exploded during COVID. It's been very interesting to see the success of so many companies. And obviously that innovation is going to grow in the years to come. That brings me to a kind of, Maria, I know you do a lot of work with your with the universities and feel quite passionate about how lawyers need to adopt innovative ways and they need new skills. So we are seeing that lawyers are changing, the behavior is changing, the courts are changing. But what do you think will be the biggest change and going forward, what would students and young lawyers need to adopt to kind of drive that innovation and make sure that this is a breaking point into, you know, a breaking point of practice, that we break out of a certain model that we're so stuck in?
Well, I think you said it already. I think the public administration in the broader sense, courts, tax authority, any kind of procedure that you have to do to obtain a paper, a license, whatever, I think that is going to be the biggest driver. The moment all these administrations embrace digital signature, digital communications, and blockchain, and even artificial intelligence, I think that the rest will come because there will be no way. But it will take time until that happens because it's costly, because it's difficult. You have to change culture. You have to change the jobs of people that are comfortable in their actual position. So it will take 20 years probably. I would say that. Yeah, really. I mean, and I'm positive. I think 20 years is not so much, but I think it will take 20 years to really have a real e-administration, a real one, not one that says that e-administration, one that where you don't need any paper, you just do a click, you look at the screen and it identifies you and you can sign contracts with them or get papers or exchange information. So 20 years. But I think
I understand what you are saying, because there's a difference between the short term online that most of the administrations have gone on. Like in South Africa, I speak from this perspective. Many courts have started using Teams or Zoom to do digital hearings and have tried, you know, it's like a mix of different platforms to make the case, you know, to see through the case. But it's not yet a sufficient model that can scale. It's good for a transitional period, but it's by no means in the long run going to work. So I suppose the question is, do we post lockdown somewhere in 2021 or 2022, do we revert back to the court system as it was while they start designing new technologies, or what do you think will happen?
You know, what I think or what I wish is that let me tell you something. What I think is that in the last years, we have been working in the short term. Everybody, governments, businesses, we as citizens, we have been living in the short term. So we plan for tomorrow, and let's say the longest I dare, for instance, to do a strategic plan for my client, for my lawyer clients, it was 1 year, and it was even too long. I could, let's say, plan for 6 months. But I think what this crisis is showing us, and not only this crisis, but also the big environmental problems the world is experiencing, is that we cannot any longer think and work and act in such a short term. We should start thinking in the long term. And I really hope that in the field of justice, we also do that. And thinking in the long term is not using the same kind of institutions, procedures, and let's say a way of solving things as in the past, because I think that the past is inherited. And maybe it's time to think of the long term and start rethinking and redesigning law and justice. For instance, I believe that now we cannot have more proofs. Judicial system is not good. We have tons of files waiting for a solution, of course, because of the pandemic, because here in Spain, they just more or less closed the courts. They only left some ones open for urgent fields, but all the civil servants, they stay at home, safe. Okay, but You know, for big conflicts, you cannot stay at home. They have to find a solution, because the later you do it, sometimes the worse the conflict is. So I hope that we have the chance now to start thinking, is really going into the core, the way to solve conflicts, for instance, is creating a company in my country, for instance, the way we do it, the right one? I think it's completely nonsense. Do business people have to fulfill all these stupid obligations that have nothing to do, that don't even allow you to do business? I mean, I always say that if you want to fulfill all your obligations as business, you cannot work in your business. You just have to fulfill obligations. I mean, that doesn't make sense. So we are doing things wrong. And now we have time to rethink them, because, as you said, remote work is here and is going to stay. I'm fully sure that people are going to save as much money as they can with space rental. And a lot of other things will not go back to what they were. So now it's time to rethink the system. That's my...
I agree with you. And I agree with you on that long... We are prone to short-term thinking in the legal industry, and we kind of plaster problems as we go. The court system is probably the biggest problem in most jurisdictions for not being a very effective way to resolve disputes. We've got all these informal pathways that are sprouting up, you know, like almost like ivies around this traditional thing that just persists to be. And I suppose now with long-term thinking, people are so scared of long-term thinking because they are saying the future is unknown. How can we plan for the future if we don't know? It's too uncertain. So they are being stuck in a short-term thing. But I suppose the biggest thing at the moment is to kind of look at the justice system as a complex system and look at all the parts to it and see critically, philosophically, socially, how does that all fit together, and what can we do to change it, that we fix the structural flaws in it? One thing, for instance, that has sprouted up a lot, and Alice, you mentioned it earlier, is alternative dispute resolution through, you mentioned JUR. In South Africa, it's been something that the government has tried to get into mainstream practice without great success so far. But it is part of our South African culture is to mediate, to try and resolve conflict. And through the closure of the courts and the backlogs that there are, people are forced now to go into mediation. I mean, I see at our place, we are solving many divorces, civil disputes, and even in the criminal justice system, restorative justice is getting new attention at the moment. Alice, what is your experience of that with your work in alternative dispute resolution?
If I answer that, I just wanted to respond to what Maria had said earlier, that most of these like technologies will be fully in force in 20 years. What I have actually realized that because I think like in Africa, we have more complications with our justice system. I don't think we can actually wait for 20 years to get a solution, because right now, like I told you, the solutions we are having in legal technology to enhance our justice system, they are being implemented like right now. So meaning, and actually even the payment system, before you wonder, like in Africa, we have such a cash, most economies are cash based, right? But now with this whole mobile money, you're able to transact electronically and make payments in the justice system without actually traveling or moving. And if you can be able to file submissions online and everything, I don't think in Africa it will take 20 years, because the need and the crisis is, I think, is quite high. And our problems are too big. I don't think 20 years, I find that 20 years is such a long period. Africa has long-standing problems, heavy problems in our justice system. Any technology that is on the market that can help to solve some of those problems, because our breadths of access to justice are quite low. But I can imagine in the developed world where, I'll give an example, Jackie, the JUR system, the JUR platform. Mm. If you talk about the JUR platform to someone in Sweden or Norway, where everything has always been like perfectly fine, their justice system does not have the same problems. They're like, so what is JUR going to do? Yet in my country, it will be like the difference between night and day. In most Nordic countries where they have almost perfect systems, they won't see the need for these technologies at all. And most of it will take a much longer time to implement them. That's what I was trying to say. That the need this side is quite high.
It's an interesting thing you raise, because I think COVID has opened up kind of a different window to our different realities that we have. All countries are faced with the same pandemic, but it has exposed a lot of different problems in the different jurisdictions. So Africa has been exposed to the great inequality that prevails, the breakdown in so many systems. And as you say, we can't afford to wait, yet at the same time, the government has to spend on, will the government be spending on justice while people are starving? And are they going to, so much of the funds are going to COVID relief programs and more dire problems in the view of the government often. So it's going to be interesting to see how that differs to the responses of other jurisdictions that have perhaps the ability to still spearhead justice, because they don't have that tremendous backlog, you know, social backlog. Maria, what are you seeing? Do you think that the government will, in how they are investing in the Justice Department, are they prioritizing funds to the Justice Department? Have they cut budgets to the Justice Department, or how are they changing their spend?
Well, I think they have, in my country, we have a lot of political struggle, and we are using the same budget as 3 years ago. So, you know, this is public administration. You cannot just say, okay, I get more money because, you know, I need more. It's just you have what is in the budget. So we have, I think it's a 3 years old budget, because they have they have not agreed on the new budget. They are trying, but they haven't got that consensus. So same amount of money as 3 years ago, I guess. And the only thing is that now the new minister, he's there since 1 year ago, I think. He has a plan, a strategic plan. So he got a plan called Justice Plan 3030, I think. So it's a plan for looking at 10 years. And his goals in the case of Spain is connecting the regional judicial systems with the national ones, because, you know, we have 17 regions here. And a lot of them have got a capacity for judicial, for justice affairs, not all of them, but a lot of them. And then there is a problem, because we don't have data for the whole country. So we don't have, a system for the whole country, let's say just a communication system, lawyers, police, courts, and procurador, which I don't know how to say in English, is the person who gets paper in the court and brings it to the lawyer. These people are connected by, let's say, a more or less fax, but which is digital. And that's what we have. It's called LexNet. But we don't have one, let's say, unique number per procedure of Spain. So we don't have numbers. One of the big problems we have is data. And they want to work in data, and they have the challenge of getting data, valid data for the whole country, so that we know that in Andalusia is better than in Catalonia. And I think that that's very good, more transparency in the system. So they're going to work in that, in a lot of like technology, so that the systems interconnect, and then data. They also want to work on alternative dispute resolution systems, so more mediation, because they realize that the courts cannot cope with the amount of work, and it's not a question of, you know, putting money and creating 20,000 more courts. It's going to keep from being a problem. So that's what they are mainly doing from the justice side. Because one problem as well, another problem, one challenge is that we have like one unit now, one ministry, which is in charge of digital agenda. So the digital agenda people are also working with solutions for artificial intelligence, etc. So, you know, we still have that problem of like justice in one side and the digital agenda in the other, and then each region doing its own agenda and, you know, coordination. And coordination, I think, is a problem everywhere. And in Europe is a big problem, as we have seen with the COVID. Mm. Maybe something we should talk about. You know, mm. it's amazing that we still don't have one app for the whole of Europe, because we are a country. I mean, Europe is a country. We can move from one country to the other. But, you know, mm. we are controlling.
I think that that coordination is so, so critical. And for the legal industry at large, no matter what jurisdiction you're in, when we're moving into alternative dispute resolution and technology, there's so much sharing to be done that is not bound by the laws of the country, but is bound by the technology and the ability yeah. Of us to share and build better systems. But I think as we should probably start finishing off. So I want to go back to practice and the role of the lawyer and just ask you as a parting last question, what are the main trends that you've observed in how the lawyers have changed their behavior, and maybe specifically with mention to the business model? I know it's something lawyers don't always want to talk about, the billable hour and business models of law. But have you seen any significant innovations?
Yeah, in my world, we've not had really mind-blowing innovations in terms of change of business structures or models. But what I see gradually that is happening is that lawyers are softly letting go of the old structures, meaning there's more like relaxed structure in terms of, you know, the whole hierarchy where like partner, this and that. Mm-hmm. I see it breaking down where the young lawyers have more like space to either like do so many things on behalf of the firm. That is one, but also to use like different platforms to be able to deliver whatever they have to deliver, rather to deliver their work. Yet the old structure has always been, you get into office, you have to work from office, you have to use the particular specific platform that the office has provided. You can't, you know, your senior or your partner, the partner of course the approvals are still pretty much the same, but I find that the structure is kind of mellowing. Actually, that's what I'd say. It's no longer the hardcore traditional way of engagement, meaning the seniors and the juniors. I find that juniors have more space definitely to do what they want to do, as opposed to 20 years ago. That's something that I was used to. And then the billing, I think there's a very, very big shift in terms of billing. Lawyers have finally accepted that clients are not interested in our hourly billing. They are more into fixed rates agreed rates. That's it. Nothing like, I'm going to charge you per hour for this and that. I find that the hourly structure is almost completely gone. Very few clients now do accept hourly rates. Then change in business model I'm seeing is non-legal staff being more involved in the core business of the law. Like for example, especially the IT sector. When I joined legal practice, it was always, you know, most of the meetings you'd have, it was more about lawyers, right? Mm-hmm. But now you have all these IT specialists definitely coming to the center of the business, because all the technologies we are using now, definitely either they have to be approved by them or recommended by them. Do you understand? So it's again, that hierarchy is also, you know, being broken down slowly from the usual traditional law firm model. And then maybe in terms of resolving disputes, I find that so many of our clients, and actually also lawyers, are more willing to engage out of court. I don't know if we've become less litigious, or because maybe our courts have been what they call it, they're overwhelmed. Or, you know, that whole idea of filing a suit and waiting for 8 years, 10 years to get justice. I find that so many like lawyers are going more into alternative dispute resolution, out of court settlements. And actually this mediation is also taking place online. And some firms have structured like their dispute resolution to have a core mediation where you actually from the beginning engage that client to try and settle. That's the trend.
Those are very positive changes. Maria, do you have something to add to that?
Well, I'm going to tell you what I have seen here in Europe. I have seen mainly six trends. So one, probably this should not be number one in importance, but I'm very happy that it is happening. And every month there is two or three of these cases. Law firms are setting up an area devoted to legal tech services. So they render services related to legal technology, etc. Second trend I notice is that a lot of law firms are developing legal technology. So they are launching apps and websites and platforms. The third trend I notice is training. I get applications for being trained in digital transformation, legal design thinking every week. So a lot of people want to learn about this. The fourth trend is working at home. Lawyers have discovered that they didn't need to go to the office and that they can work from home. So I think that is going to change as well. The whole culture of law firms, which was a lot of, at least in my country, presentialism, working really long hours. I remember the last law firm where I work, my normal time to get home was 9 o'clock at night. And I was one of the first to leave, imagine. And then fifth, partnership with companies that have nothing to do with law. So it could be communications, it could be PR, it could be lobby, it could be environment, but they are partnering. And that's something they didn't do before so often. And then last but not least, digital marketing. Lawyers suddenly love LinkedIn, love webinars and love newsletters, which is kind of boring because they are all doing the same. So at the moment we have all of them super active doing content for LinkedIn and organizing webinars. There are 20 webinars per day on legal issues. And that's where we are. So those are the trends.
That's very interesting, Maria, because I see that definitely at a global scale, but not in my world. And I don't know, Jackie, you can attest to this, not much on the continent, that law firms on the African continent are...
I'm seeing that in some aspects in South Africa, but I think that is a wonderful place to be at, is that the legal industry is diverging and there's innovation happening and these trends are playing out in different ways in the different countries. And the most important thing about this whole pandemic to the legal industry, I find, is for the first time lawyers are thinking how to do things differently. Like you said, one of the trends you mentioned, Maria, about partnering with different organizations and different companies, lawyers are questioning their business model, they're questioning the problems they set to solve, they're questioning the tools they have to solve these things. And I think that is probably the greatest gift that we have received from this year, because through this, I think true innovation and structural change will happen in the coming years. Hopefully not 20 years as Maria predicted. I've always been an optimist, and I think we will start seeing quicker changes because we have more people taking part in the legal industry. And we've got more people investing in the legal industry, and we've got more people wanting to innovate in this field. But saying that, we are at different intervals of the future, and how Uganda responds will be different to how New York responds and how someone in Madrid will take it. But may we learn from one another and learn from the trends and see what works and what problems we get to solve.
Maybe in response to what Maria talked about, the collaborations and for setting up legal tech departments, in most jurisdictions in Africa, what I see most are alternatives to law firms, like virtual law firms. You find that is what we are happening, as in it's not happening in mainstream law firms, but you have different people setting up like virtual platforms or apps in terms of delivering legal services, but completely different from law firm structures. I think maybe what I see that might happen later is that that the virtual law firms will have to merge with the like existing or the old law firms, because the virtual law firms right now, they are facing a lot of backlash from our regulators, because our regulatory authority does not really understand them in that space. So, and our laws definitely are still need a lot to be done, because they don't provide for virtual operations of a lawyer. But what I see is that there are so many like virtual platforms that have come up. So how do they operate? Like me as a lawyer and an individual, I have a license to provide legal services. So I set up a virtual platform where I can be able to receive, but like provide legal services. So yeah, and I think that that came from a, like a frustration where if you have like a platform or something you'd want to share or you'd want your law firm to take on, and they're not willing to take it up, the best way is definitely to go your way and start up something. So
yeah, absolutely. But I think that's a, that's an important point as well to raise, that they, I think I often see that lawyers think it has to be either or, you know, you've got to either bill by the hour or we've got to go this way, where in this time we are seeing there's space for everything. So there's space for virtual law firms, there's space for access to justice initiatives, there's space for big law, there's space for legal technology, and may they all coexist, because I believe through that coexistence, we are building a new legal economy that is quite exciting, and we will learn a lot through the process, and more brain power is being pulled into the legal landscape, which will aid society and lawyers and everyone in the long run. To finish off, I would just like to thank both of you for your time. I would like to thank Samantha for helping us set up this podcast. It's been a great to learn from your jurisdictions, from your countries, and to hear what you are doing and your experiences of the COVID impact on lawyers. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you so much, Alice, Jackie, and Maria, for taking us through an engaging conversation around the lawyer's role in COVID-19. I thoroughly enjoyed hearing your unique perspectives and how things are similar as well as different across South Africa, Uganda, and Spain around the lawyer's role during the pandemic. I believe later in the series, we'll have the three of you cover the client, how the client behavior has changed as well, which I'm so looking forward to hearing about. For those listening in today, please keep an eye out for more episodes brought to you by the 2020 Influential Women in Legal Tech honorees and produced by the International Legal Technology Association.